a man who has had a vision of Chemnitz as a theologian, as one of the great men of God, as the second Martin, as a man who contributed substantially to the peace and prosperity and blessing of the Lutheran Church. I don't need to introduce him. We'll simply turn the podium over to him, Dr. Preuss, to tell us about Chemnitz the theologian. Jack, it's yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Klutz. By way of introduction, let me make 2 points. First of all, first I want to thank you, John, and all of the colleagues here for these very happy 3 months that I have spent as a member of this faculty on this campus. It's been a very pleasant experience. The day after I announced that I was not a candidate for synodical presidency, Ralph Bowman called me, and he said, I think you might suffer from some withdrawal symptoms or something, and maybe you'd like to have a stint of teaching here on the campus. Well, I rather hastily accepted the invitation because, frankly, having gotten up here and trying to commute between here and Arkansas in January of 1982, has not been exactly a restful or even a withdrawing activity. But anyway, it has been a great pleasure to be here and to get to know some of you better and to get to know some of you for the first time. I'm very pleased with the students. I think I don't know who's instrumental in producing them to the point where they are as grad students and Sem 4s, but they certainly show a fine attitude, and I think the faculty deserves a great deal of commendation for the excellent job you've done. The second preliminary remark is to pick up John on his comments relative to this household business. For years, both at Springfield and on at 500, I was a pen pal of David Hassold. And if you think that what you got from him in the car is something, you should see when he's had time to sit down and really write this stuff out. It's incredible. And I met him once in Australia, and he looked perfectly sane to me, but I found out later they had committed him. Well, at any rate, meeting the Hassold family through that avenue would lead one to believe that there might be more of the same if you got farther into the thing. So when the old gentleman's translation of Chemnitz Examen became known to the Western world, I think it was with a little bit of trepidation that I didn't realize that you'd been involved in this, but anyway, later on, the whole thing was sent up to Springfield. I think it was only because the old gentleman was a Springfield grad of about 1899 or something, and it came up in four, we thought for a moment we'd gotten 4 copies of the Gutenberg Bible, because it was about this big, each about that thick, typed and written in King James English. And I thought it was very interesting that it came out in one of the classes here the other day that when asked why did he do this work, which took him over 30 years, he said, I did it for exactly the same reason that Chemnitz wrote it in the first place, because the church needs to hear the kind of thing that he was saying. And my own role in this has been kind of that of a bridesmaid. I took my degree in translation, wrote a thesis in the subject of the philosophy of translation. I've always been interested in it, but was never very highly regarded. Some years after I wrote the thesis, I went back to the University of Minnesota and took it out and discovered that not one single human being had ever taken that book out of the Minnesota University Library. In fact, I think I could probably go back and find the same thing be the case today. So, I mean, it was not a meteoric success that I had. And I got the first translation work I ever did was on this work, which is now being republished, I guess, in the Concordia Heritage series called The Doctrine of Man, edited by Hermann Preuss. And Hermann didn't think much of me either, but he'd asked a professor at St. Olaf College to translate the Chemnitz part, and the guy had done such an atrocious job that Herman came to me and he said, I wonder if you'd mind revising this. That was my first introduction to the art of translation. Then I got invited to translate one of the volumes of Luther, and that was only because the first translator was a Roman Catholic who couldn't understand the meaning of the Latin word justitia, and the second translator died. He was from the ALC. So finally, they said, well, maybe at least this guy might survive it. He seems healthy enough. And then I got the assignment to do the De Duabis, and that was sort of with the premise, it's likely that nobody will buy it, but we think it has value being in some archive. And then finally, I got one really on my own, and they gave me the De Coena Domini. In the meantime, Fred Kramer had picked up the work on the examen, and this was clipping out pretty well. By the way, the third volume has been turned into CPH and is going through the glacial editorial process down there and may appear by the year 2000 with a little bit of luck. And now I'm working on the Loci Communes, which is really his greatest work. I think many ways more significant than his examen, and that was my main reason for retirement, because if I don't get at it and work at it, I'll never live long enough to get that done. But it is very interesting to be part of a process whereby a totally unknown and obscure, long-forgotten theologian is really being brought back to life with some hurdles and some difficulties. But I don't think that Lutheranism is ever going to be able to operate without reference to Chemnitz again, because one of my theses in talking to you today is that I think that in certain ways Martin Chemnitz is the father of what we might call normative systematic Lutheranism, normative Lutheranism in the sense of systematic theology. Any of you who've done any reading in Luther, and we all have one way or another, recognize that Luther was a meteor, a Halley's Comet. There's only one of him in a millennium. And he had tremendous charisma. I think Luther must have gotten to the point where no matter what he said, somebody thought it was of importance. And yet, as you read it, you say, it's kind of hard to find your way through this. It's not always completely consistent with itself. The Luther of 1517 is a considerably different Luther from the Luther of 1540, and so forth. And then, having gotten this thing going, having spent the last 30 years of his life on the Reformation movement, and having started something that involved nations, that brought about wars, that really, in a sense, overturned the papacy and altered the course of the history of the world from that time forevermore, he then picked a very convenient time to die. You remember that a year after his death, the Emperor Charles V stood at his grave as a conquering hero, and somebody, probably some fellow in a clerical collar, said, why don't you dig him up and burn him? And Charles most magnanimously said, my quarrel is with the living, not with the dead. But, of course, the quarrel with that dead man really has never yet been settled. But anyway, it's my opinion, and some of you historians may very much disagree with me, that had Lutheranism reached its pinnacle with the death of Luther, and had there not been that second Martin, I don't think we'd ever have heard of it today. Not only because of the military victories of the papists and the divisions brought about in the Protestant camp by the Reformed, but because really I don't think Melanchthon really even quite deserves as much credit as he's gotten for being the interim leader or the successor of Chemnitz. As I read his Loci Communes alongside of Chemnitz Loci Communes, it's like it's far, far greater comparison than there is between Pieper's Dogmatics and J.T. Miller's, or the fellow that was at River Forest, I always forget his name, or even the Schwann Catechism. The breadth and depth of theological understanding that Chemnitz brings far exceeds anything that Melanchthon put into it in the first place. And I become very interested in Chemnitz. First, I was interested in him, of course, only as a piece of literature. And he's hard to get out of his literature because he never talks about himself. He never has any personal references. From the stuff he writes in the theological realm, you wouldn't know whether what century he lived in, what nationality he was, whether he was married, whether he had any children, whether he had any ideas on anything. The material in the Loci Communes, or the Examen, or the De Duabus, or the De Coena, is so totally objective that you know absolutely nothing about the man. He did, at one point in his life, must have been a kind of a hiatus, write a brief biography, which he says was for the sake of his children, where you learn a few things about him as a person. But he was really one of the most laid-back people that I have ever encountered. And I thought, in talking about him as a theologian, which is the general title and allows me to move in all directions. Eric wanted me to talk about Chemnitz and the Word, and I was scared to death of the assignment because Klug has written that excellent book on the subject, and if you'd compare what he writes with what I say, you'd say, why did we bother to have Preuss deliver the lecture? It's all there if you want to know what Chemnitz believes on the doctrine of the Word. But as a theologian, we can talk about many things. He was born in the Duchy of Brandenburg, in a little village known as Treuenbritzen, which was originally called Britzen, but during one of the plagues it had stood up manfully, or some war or something, so it came to be called Faithful Britzen or Treuenbritzen. His father was named Paul, and he was a weaver, cloth salesman, apparently a man originally of some noble birth, but come upon hard times. There's no money. The date was the 9th day of November, 1522, 5 years after the events at the castle church at Wittenberg. So in a sense, you might say he was born a Lutheran. As a young man, the family didn't have much ambition. The goal would have been a couple more looms in the back end of the place. But a teacher, who himself was not of great Einstein, recommended that he be given further education. As a teenager, he was shipped off to Wittenberg, where he stayed less than a year, did not do very well in Latin, and finally dropped out. But finally, he went to school for a period from 1537 to 1544 at Magdeburg, where he was for 3 years, then also at Frankfurt on Oder, became a teacher, went back to Wittenberg, where he studied under Melanchthon in the field of astrology. But all he says in his biography about Luther is that he heard him preach. That was about the total relationship the two had. Finally, in 1548, at the age of 26, he received his degree, undertook the study of theology for a couple of years, and then begins those aspects of his career which are a little better known. He went to Königsberg in what is now Poland and taught the sons of the nobility there and worked as the librarian, apparently ingratiated himself very much with the Duke by making horoscopes for him. And although it kind of admits that he did this in about the same way that a fellow attends bar to go through Concordia Seminary, something that it was an occupation, but one that he was not overly proud of. Although he does rejoice in the fact that he did foretell the victory of Morris of Saxony over Charles V, something that nobody else at that time foretold, which put him in the class of some of the better caliber mediums of today, like those who predicted the assassination of Kennedy or such events as that. But it was during this time that he really undertook the study of theology, particularly reading in the library, and became, at least we see him emerging as quite the expert in patristic literature, which he later came to be. This is, again, not something novel. He was not the first patristics man in Lutheranism. There were many of them, the fathers of the Magdeburg centuries, Melanchthon, Luther himself was very good at it. And it was part of the educational, it was considered a part of the education of a theologian in that era. Although I know of nobody that went into it more deeply and did a more thorough job of it. In the translation on the two natures of Christ, there's one chapter which is devoted to the study of the church fathers that has over 300 footnotes. It took me over a year in preparing it simply to do that one chapter because of the enormous amount of digging that was involved with it. I have never quite understood how he did it. He wrote, apparently he mentions that he put down these things on pieces of paper, but for example, when I came to the translation of the doctrine, the one on the Lord's Supper, which relates a great deal to Christology, and both documents came out of the crypto-Calvinist sacramentarian controversy, he has a totally different batch of quotations. I thought the second time, well, this is going to be a pipe. I just used the first one. All different. And I don't know how he managed to get so many very appropriate quotations, especially when he was such a young man and really had not very thoroughly decided his theological course or what was going to become of him. He became associated, finally, in 1553, he returned to Wittenberg and there completed his theological studies and was asked by the Wittenberg faculty to lecture on Melanchthon's Loci Communes, and Melanchthon sat in on it. Now, again, I don't know just precisely whether the edition I'm using is the class notes from Wittenberg, but it would seem to me if I were Melanchthon and I went in and heard a man deliver lectures on my treatise, I'd have to say, I think I will withdraw mine, because he just simply outshines them, not only in the extent of the material, but in the depth to which he goes. The edition of Melanchthon's Loci that is used in the edition of Chemnitz is very, very minimalistic, and that of Chemnitz on the same subjects and following the same order is... I really honestly believe you could take that material and bring it into a course in Lutheran systematic theology today and say we've really got it all here, at least as far as the treatment of the basic doctrines is concerned. Then in 1554, he was called to Brunswick, Braunschweig, to act as the understudy or coadjutor of a man by the name of Merlin. Merlin plays a very important role in the life of Chemnitz, going back to the Königsberg days and all the way through the rest of Chemnitz's life. From 1554 to his death in 1586, 6 years after the Book of Concord, he always lived in and operated out of Braunschweig. Merlin did not write very much. you don't know much about him, but he appears to have been a real mentor. He appears to have been the kind of fellow who in Chemnitz saw a bright young man and said, I am going to develop, kind of like Paul did with Timothy or something. Here's somebody that has got what it takes to do the job. He had barely gotten to Braunschweig when I always felt such great empathy for this relationship, because it was like mine down at Synod. I had all the responsibility, all the authority, I got all the brickbats, and I had no time hardly to say the Lord's Prayer once in a while. That was the total of my theological studies. But I was so lucky, because I always found the Ralph Bowman or the Sam Nasker or somebody else, and sometimes they were kids right going to the seminary here at the time, to whom I could say, here's something, write this, or research that, or dig up this. And you know, it's quite, you can get to be an awfully good theologian if you can find enough fellas like that, especially who are under the payroll, so that you can make them perform and say, have it in Monday morning and at least rise by Thursday afternoon. And I think that Merlin must have been a little bit that way with Chemnitz, because although Chemnitz for a good many years, for about 13 years, was the understudy, he had hardly unpacked when Merlin says, well, we're having a little trouble on the Lord's Supper over here with a fellow by the name of Hardenberg, and I'd like you to undertake the matter. Out of which came the first came the document on the Christology, and then the one on the Lord's Supper. And I'm sorry, the order was different. The one on the Lord's Supper came first. He also was assigned by Merlin, who was, they called him general superintendent. They'd abolished the office of bishop, but I've been unable to discover any difference as far as the workload and the job description. They were what we would call bishops, and I suppose Braunschweig today has a bishop again after several centuries of lapse. But at any rate, here Chemnitz at Brunswick was ordained. He was asked immediately to begin recommence his lectures on Melanchthon's Loci Communes, which he continued almost up to the time of his death. And later, when he became the general superintendent, and I haven't discovered, maybe some of you know, how large the Duchy of Brunswick was, but he got those preachers together every 2 weeks, and they sat there and listened to him lecture on Melanchthon's Loci Communes. And he quizzed them, and he tested them, and then later, as time went on, and they began a sort of a Springfield setup, and they needed other men in, and they had a colloquy program, and they didn't feel very comfortable with it, because they said, if these guys get through this thing, they'll become college presidents, and we got to know that they know something. And so then they asked Chemnitz, or maybe he volunteered. He produced this notable little Enchiridion, which our friend Daniel Pellet translated, a very neat piece of work. Except that Daniel is so literalistic that it's almost impossible to read. It's a little bit like St. Jerome's Vulgate, but he produced this Enchiridion, and every one of these colloquy guys that came in was handed a copy of this and said, read, mark, learn, inwardly digest, and regurgitate, which they did, as a way, and it's really quite a remarkable thing that you have the Loci Communes that's about that big, and as you know, the examen is going to be about that big, and he's got that whole thing boiled down into something about that big. It's quite remarkable as to show the ability of a fellow not only to go down deep and stay down long and come up dry, but even to be able to summarize it, and that's something that very few of us faculty people have ever been able to do. So in 1561, he first publishes the De Coena Domini. Then in 1562, he gets interested in the Jesuits. Who are these people? I want to know something about these characters. And he writes this little treatise on the Jesuits, which then in turn leads him to produce the Examen, which he was working on even while the Council of Trent was in session. He was not a slow operator. I guess as soon as first session ended and they published the results, he said, aha, and started in. In 1567, he became the superintendent of Brunswick, and things are so modern. The first thing he asked for upon the election of bishop was, I need a leave of absence. I'd like to go to Rostock and finish my doctor's degree. And which they did. I understand they got a grant from the Aid Association for Lutherans. And he hopped off to Rostock and completed it. My guess is, although I'm not authority at this moment, that he wrote his doctorate on the subject of Christology. I think it's what we call a libellum, which is floating around in one or two libraries in the world. He no sooner got his doctorate than he was called upon by the Duke of Brunswick and also the Duke of Prussia to undertake a reformation of those two duchies. And by that, it meant making visitations in the churches, a la Luther's visitation articles, and upgrading the education of clergy, organizing the congregational life, doing what we today probably would call preparing handbooks for the church bodies. But most important of all, they prepared what they called, in Brunswick, it was called the Corpus Julian, and in Prussia, it bore also the name of the Duke, whose name escapes me. Anyway, these were corpora doctrinae, bodies of doctrine, statements of doctrine, of what the belief is of this particular church, and they are antecedent documents to the Lutheran confessions. These things were brought in as part of the data from which the formula of Concord was ultimately adopted. In other words, when Chemnitz was involved in the writing of the formula, he came in as a very experienced writer of church doctrinal statements. And I suppose some historical critic could go through these and show wherein each part was utilized in later material. By this time, you see, he's a man of about 40 years of age, right in the prime of life, and seemingly was recognized through all of North Germany as a very explicit and precise theologian. He kept on with his lectures on the Loci Communes, which were finally published after his death by Polycarp Leiser in 1591. Along in this period, he also began, in 1570, he published his Two Natures of Christ, something that he'd been really kind of filing away on for nearly 20 years. And then he begins his study of his production known as the Harmonia Evangelica, the Harmony of the Gospels, which went through many different versions and translations and finally came out under the name of Chemnitz, Leiser, and John Gerhard about the middle of the 17th century. And very interestingly enough, it was picked up in the late 19th century by Johannes Ylvisaker of the Old Norwegian Synod and is the basis for a book which is being sold over here all the time called The Gospels. It was first published by Augsburg, got a little bit too conservative for them. I think it's now being published by either Northwestern or CPH. But it lives on, this magnificent harmony of the Gospels that was produced. Now, I don't want to go into all of it. I've given you a little bit on his life and his development. I had my course lined up under several different headings, some of which I'll talk to you about in the form of about one paragraph.